When I was a youth in junior high or high school, I hated history. I don't know if you hated history when you were in school, but I hated history. I found it boring. I did not like dates. I did not like to memorize dates. I didn't like to memorize names. Stalin was like, who cares? Hitler, like, why is he important? Charles de Gaulle and Napoleon, I mean, like, that wasn't something that was exciting for me at all. I just wasn't interested in history. It was really boring to me. And my attitude was basically like, well, who cares? Who cares what happened in the prehistoric days? You know, I mean, like, who cares? Well, little did I know, but a man by the name of Marcus Garvey described me very well. And I am afraid describes probably a lot of other people who find history to be boring and unimportant as well. He said, a people without the knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots. And he said it right. He said it really well. And when I began to study the Bible, I discovered that he was correct. Because as I began to study the Bible, I found out that I needed to know something about ancient history. And I found out that I needed to know Old Testament history if I was to understand the New Testament. There are parts of the New Testament you cannot understand very well unless you understand Old Testament. And in fact, you have to know the Old Testament scriptures reasonably well on many occasions to understand statements in the New Testament. In fact, many New Testament statements are nothing more than Old Testament quotes. And so I found out that his comment was really important. You have to know history, you have to know origins, and you have to know culture. And it was essential to understanding the Bible and understanding my faith. Well, look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 11. Ecclesiastes 1, 11 captures the problem really well. Solomon wrote this. Ecclesiastes 1 is one of my favorite chapters in the Bible. Not the favorite chapter, but one of them. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 11, we read this, and there is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of the latter things which will occur, and there will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. What's the message? There's no remembrance of the earlier things. You can't remember the old stuff. I mean, like, think about it. Dial history back 5,000 years, 2 months, and 1 day, and tell me what happened. You can't. I can't. I mean, we don't know what happened in history past. And the only way that you get any clue, any semblance of what happened in the past is somebody wrote something to tell you what happened. Or you go to the Old Testament or the New Testament to find out what happened. Solomon was absolutely correct. He says, there is no remembrance of earlier things. And then he says, and also of the latter things that will occur. You don't know what's coming. You have no clue about the past. You have no clue about the future. The point is that you need to have history. You need to have somebody write something if you want to know what happened in the past. Or look at Romans 15. Romans 15 tells us why Scripture was given to us. It's given to us for a good reason. Romans 15, and look at verse 4. Romans 15, verse 4 says, for whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope. You know why the Scriptures were written? For our instruction. Watch this. History, historical facts, historical information was written for our instruction. 1 Corinthians 10:11 says almost the same thing. It says, now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So Paul writes again in 1 Corinthians that these things were written for our instruction. What was written? History, origins, and culture, cultural information. Why? So that we would be instructed, that they are examples, so that we can, let me add this, that we can also understand the New Testament. We can understand the Old Testament. Well, our study this morning is a continuation of history. Daniel 1 was historical. All of Daniel 1 was historical. Daniel 1 was a historical statement, and it told us about Daniel. It told us who he was. It told us about King Nebuchadnezzar. It told us about Daniel's friends. It was historical in nature. Well, our study this morning is in Daniel chapter 2, and it's also historical in nature. It's also a part of history, and what we're going to discover is that chapter 2 is the key. Now watch this. This is an important statement on my part. Daniel chapter 2 is the key to understanding most of the rest of Daniel. Without Daniel 2, what you're going to discover in this chapter, without an understanding of what's in Daniel chapter 2, you can't really understand the rest of the book. And you won't be able to understand a good part of the minor prophets, and you will not be able to understand Revelation, our future. Harry Ironside put it this way. He said, the second chapter of Daniel is the ABC of prophecy. And he's absolutely right. Daniel 2 is the ABCs of prophecy. It helps you put it all together. Daniel 2 is going to give us a bird's eye view of history, or an outline of history. And then we're going to see that the rest of Daniel is all connected to chapter 2. So chapter 2 is the beginning. And what we're going to also discover is that Daniel chapter 2 actually starts history from 605 BC and takes us all the way to the end of time. So let's begin our study. It's in Daniel chapter 2 this morning, and we're going to discover that this is about a guy having a dream, Nebuchadnezzar having a dream. Verse 1 says, and now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. The first thing I want you to notice in this verse is that we are told that this is now the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. This is an important piece of information. We're told that this is the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, and what we've pointed out in the past is that the Babylonians had a different way of counting a man's reign versus how the Jews counted the reign of a king. What the Babylonians did is that the Babylonians counted the first year as the ascension year of the king. In other words, when a man became king, the first year was his ascension year. The second year that he was king, it was counted as actually the first year of his reign. That was the Babylonian culture, which is history, historical facts. And then the third year that he was king was counted as the second year of his reign. The Jews, however, they had a different way of counting the reign of a king. They counted the reign of a king like we do today. The year that a man becomes king would be the first year of his reign, the second year would be the second year of his reign, and the third year would be the third year of his reign. So the Jews counted it different than the Babylonians did. And what Daniel does here in the book of Daniel is Daniel follows the Babylonian culture. Daniel follows the Babylonian practice, the custom of the day. Now, if you were to go look at 2 Kings or you'll read Jeremiah, what you find out is that Jeremiah, as we saw in our last study, he follows the Jewish pattern. And so we were told in Jeremiah that when Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem, took a bunch of people from Jerusalem and ported them over to Babylon, we are told by Jeremiah that it was the fourth year of Jehoiakim. But if you go back to Daniel 1:1, you find out that Daniel says it's the third year. There's 1 year off. And that's because they counted the reign of a king differently, the Jews did versus the Babylonians. Okay? So what Daniel is doing in the book of Daniel is he's in Babylon. It's the culture of the Babylonians. And he's following the Babylonian custom. So in Daniel 1:1, we are told that Nebuchadnezzar is king of Babylon. Well, it turns out that this is 605 BC. And in 605 BC, history tells us that Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabopolassar, died. We're also told that he made an a hasty return to the city of Babylon to secure his position as king, and then he came back. He came back to Judah. He came back to Jerusalem. And then if you look at verse 5, we're told that four guys, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or as we know of as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, will be educated for 3 years. So from verse 1, you're counting 3 years. That's 605 B.C. If you count 3 years from 605 B.C., that takes you to 603 or 602, depending upon what part of 605 we're in. Then in verse 18, we're told, and then at the end of the days that the king has specified for presenting them, that is, the four guys, the four men were to come and stand before the king, the end of the days, that's the end of the 3 years. So when you get to verse 18, we made the point last time that 3 years have elapsed. And so when verse 18 occurs at 603 and 602 B.C., now we're being a little technical here for a minute, and there's a reason why, so just hang on. And so they come before the king in verse 18. Verse 19 and 20 basically tell us that Daniel and Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego are really great guys, and they are admitted to the king's service, personal service, at the end of verse 19. And when we come to verse 1, chapter 2, guess how much time has gone by since verse 1 of chapter 1? 3 years have gone by. And so when you come to verse 1 of chapter 2, it is 603 and 602 B.C., and watch what it says. And now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Well, how can it be the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar if 3 years have gone by since he became king? The only way that can happen is that Daniel's using a different way of counting than you and I normally count. And the way he's counting is that the first year is the ascension year, and then the next year is the first year of his reign, and the third year is actually called the second year of the king's reign. So what Daniel does, all you have to do is read the book of Daniel. Read chapter 1 and read chapter 2, and you find out immediately that Daniel is using a different way of counting the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, this is important. The reason I did this, wade you through all of the calculations here, is that the critics for years have ridiculed Daniel as being inaccurate on this point, saying, hey, you know, Daniel, he's not being very accurate. Well, they continued to criticize Daniel until a gentleman by the name of Edwin Thiel wrote a book called The Mystery Numbers of the Hebrew Kings. And I'll reference you to page 43 and 44 and pages 183 to 185. And in that book, he presented convincing proof that the Hebrews, that the Jews, had a different way of counting a king's reign than the Babylonians did. Really important book. And so you know what the critics did? The critics said, oh, okay, all right, okay, we're mistaken, and they moved on to another criticism, which is our normal process. Once shown that they're wrong, they don't stop criticizing, they just move on to a new one. So verse 1 says, and now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, it's actually the third year, the way we would count, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. I want you to notice that Nebuchadnezzar is in view here. That's the second thing I want you to notice. I did a survey of the Old Testament. I found out that Nebuchadnezzar, the name, occurs 91 times in the Old Testament. That's a lot. 91 times in the Old Testament. And what I discovered as I was looking through the different verses is that in Jeremiah 27, verse 6, that God calls Nebuchadnezzar my servant. Isn't that fabulous? God calls this heathen king, God calls this unbeliever my servant. Now, I want to be God's servant. I want to be pleasing to my Lord. I really do want to please my Lord. You know what God calls Nebuchadnezzar? My servant. That's a title, that's a label I suspect a lot of us would like to have. God calls Nebuchadnezzar his servant. Why? Because God's going to use him. And God did. God used him to accomplish his will. And this is a guy who worshiped other gods. In fact, we're told in the pages of Scripture that Babylon was a land of idols. I mean, everywhere you turn, there were idols. In fact, history tells us that Babylon had idols upon idols upon idols. They had a whole bunch of idols. And Marduk was the chief god of the Babylonians. Watch this. Nebuchadnezzar worshipped and followed Marduk. And yet God calls Nebuchadnezzar his servant. Now, what you're going to find out is that God's going to speak to this king in a dream. Check out verse 45 of Daniel 2 if you're not sure, but Daniel later on credits the dream as having come from God. He tells Nebuchadnezzar that God has revealed to you the future, so it's clear that the dream has come from God. And I was just amazed as I was thinking about this passage, is that here is a guy that God calls out as being my servant. He's a heathen king. He worships a god called Marduk, an idol, actually a demon. And what does God do? God gives this guy a dream about the future. About the future, even our future. When we get to the interpretation of the dream, we're going to find out that it's an incredible dream. And it wasn't given to a Christian. It wasn't given to a godly saint of the Old Testament. It was given to a heathen king. And what we're going to discover is that the dream is about Jewish history. Have you noticed how many times the word history is showing up this morning? Or culture? Or custom? I mean, it's all over the place. Watch this. You cannot study Daniel chapter 2 and not appreciate history. In fact, you're going to discover that you have to know something about history to understand Daniel. And if you're clueless about history, Daniel won't mean a lot to you, as I've come to find out. Well, today, just to make a point, and I forgot to say this earlier, that today I have a great appreciation for history. I like history because it unlocks the Bible. It helps me understand what's going on in the Bible all too often, and especially when you come to the book of Daniel. The next thing I want you to notice in this verse, there's a lot in this little verse, believe it or not. We're told that his sleep left him. The Hebrew word actually means his sleep was destroyed. It gives you a picture that this guy was probably trying to sleep at night. He kept getting awakened. Have you ever been asleep at night and you woke up and you started thinking about something or you remembered something and you just couldn't go back to sleep because you were just preoccupied with this dream that you had and you're just going on and on, or this thing that happened or this event that occurred or this trauma or tragedy or whatever it is that you had in your life and you just can't go back to sleep and you're awake and you're awake and you're awake? That's Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar has been having, did you notice what it says, dreams. The Hebrew is very clear. It's not one dream, it's dreams, it's plural. And it's the idea that he has been repeatedly having dreams. We have no idea how many days, how many nights he's been having these dreams. The dreams have been going on for a while. And when we're told that he's troubled, the Hebrew has the idea like he's really anxious. So this guy gets awakened in the night. His sleep is destroyed. It implies to me he probably got up in the middle of the night. In fact, that happened to me a couple of weeks ago. It was about 3:30 in the morning, and I remember being awakened, and something was on my mind, and I couldn't get it off of my mind. And every time I tried to go to sleep, the next thing was I was just thinking about this thing. So I finally said, this is crazy. I'll just get up. Watch it. My sleep was destroyed. I couldn't sleep. So why lay there in bed? Maybe I'll go back to sleep, but I had been trying that for a while. So that's King Nebuchadnezzar. His sleep is destroyed. He gets up, verse 2, and the king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. And so they came in and stood before the king. Now, when it tells us that the king gave orders, the Hebrew tense of this verb is imperfect. And it implies something that happened in the past. And the imperfect implies something that repeatedly is happening. So here's the picture that's being painted for us in the Hebrew text. The picture is that this king, he gets up in the middle of the night, or whenever it was he got up, he can't go back to sleep, and he gives orders for these men to come to him. And the imperfect implies he keeps giving the orders. You know what that implies? The guy's impatient. And he's demanding. The king is demanding. Is he impatient? I suspect he gave the orders and he probably waited a little bit and they didn't come. And so he gave another order. He thought, come on, get these guys in here. And so they didn't come. And he gives another order. The implication, he keeps doing it. He does it, and he does it, and he does it. He's repeatedly doing this. That's the picture of this guy. He's impatient. He can't wait for these guys to get there. I suspect that they got awoken in the night. They probably have to get themselves all fixed up. And who knows where they were living in the city, and they were coming. And so that's the picture of an impatient, demanding king, and he wants to know what the meaning of his dream is. So who does he call? He calls four kinds of people. We're told they're magicians, they're conjurers, they're sorcerers, and they're Chaldeans. Magicians, the literal Hebrew is scratchers. That's the literal meaning of the word. If you recall that the Babylonians, they wrote in cuneiform. So they took a little stylus, made little impressions in the mud, so they watched that they were scratchers. So that's kind of the picture of the magicians. When we're told they're conjurers, it's actually referring to the priests of Ashupu. Ashupu was a god, by the way. This basically means that they communicated with the spirits, they cast spells. So that would be the conjurers. Sorcerers is typically sorcery, which we think of as witchcraft. That would be incantations. They were involved in things that witches do. And then we're told Chaldeans. There's actually two different definitions of Chaldeans. And it's important to notice this. The first is that Chaldeans could be used in a national sense to refer to the nation of Babylon or Chaldeans who lived in that region. So it could be used in a national sense. But it's used probably more in more of a technical sense here in this passage, to refer to astrologers, men who were involved in astrology. And what history tells us is that they kept very accurate records. In fact, it's interesting that J.C. Whitcomb, in his commentary on Daniel on pages 36 to 37, he states that the astrologers of Babylon, they were very accurate in their calculation of the length of the year. They were so accurate that they were within 5/1000ths of a percent of the real number. In other words, they had an error of 5/1000ths of a percent. I mean, that's accurate. And for those of you who want an actual number, it's 26 minutes and 55 seconds. They were that close. I mean, that tells you something about these astrologers or these Chaldeans. So what King Nebuchadnezzar does is he calls four groups of men. Almost all of them are involved in the cult in one way or another. And probably even the Chaldeans were involved in astrology because they thought it gave them probably wisdom of the future and wisdom of the present. And so they studied the stars for insight. It's probably the reason they did that. But watch this. These are smart men. These aren't stupid men. It reminds me of Romans where it says, professing to be wise, they became fools. Did you know you can be smart but not wise? You can have a great IQ and not be wise. Just because you're brilliant doesn't mean you're wise, doesn't mean you have biblical perspective, doesn't mean you have spiritual insight. You can be a smart person and yet be involved in the occult and be absolutely unwise. So the king calls these supposed wise guys to him, and he says that he wants them to tell the king his dreams. And so they came and they stood before the king. Now, the word for before I thought was kind of interesting. It actually means in the Hebrew, face. So it means that these four groups of men, they come and they stand before the face of the king. Now, catch the picture. Here's this impatient king. He's awakened in the middle of the night. We don't know if this meeting that's occurring is in the middle of the night, but this is a meeting that's coming up. These men finally arise, and who knows who got there and who didn't get there. I suspect that he was rather impatient. He didn't care how many showed up, just as long as some guys showed up. And so these men, they come and they stand before him. It implies that the king is sitting on a throne and they're before his face. What an unbelievable picture. I mean, it's really an incredible picture. And this guy's impatient. And he can't wait for these guys. So he probably starts the meeting as soon as he gets anybody. He doesn't wait for everybody to show up. Verse 3. And the king says to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. Now, I want you to notice what it says. It says dream, singular, not dreams, dream. So it's been one dream that apparently has been being repeated. And that makes sense based upon what happens at the end of the chapter. And when it tells us anxious, the Hebrew is really kind of interesting as well. The actual word for trouble has the idea to thrust, like taking something and pushing down hard on something. And so it's the implication that this guy is really struggling. And so he's really anxious to understand the dream. And so verse 4, the Chaldeans respond, the astrologers spoke to the king in Aramaic. Now, Daniel is kind of an interesting book. From verse 1 of chapter 1 to verse 3 of this chapter has been a Hebrew section. Starting with verse 4 is an Aramaic section. Daniel's written in two languages. Daniel's written in Hebrew and is written in Aramaic. The Aramaic section goes from verse 4 of chapter 2 all the way through the end of Daniel 7. Now, I think there's a reason for this. And that is what we're going to find out is that in Daniel 2, there's a dream. In Daniel 2, the dream gives us a picture of history. Watch this. Jewish history all the way to the end of time. What we're going to find when we get to Daniel 7 is Daniel 7 takes us to the end of time. So I think that God intentionally gave us this section in Aramaic because it connects Daniel 2 to Daniel 7. You can't understand Daniel 7 without Daniel 2. And so I think it's intentionally given to us so we connect it all together. And then the rest of Daniel will also interface, will also connect as well. So, with verse 4, we begin the Aramaic section, and it's when the Chaldeans speak to the king, and we're told in Aramaic. And in fact, verse 4 is in Aramaic. O king, live forever. Now, have you ever watched a TV show where a bunch of people came into the king and they didn't say, oh, the king, live forever? This seems to be the standard way you greet a king. You know, O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants and we will declare the interpretation to you. So what the astrologers or what these Chaldeans are doing, they're saying, well, king, you give us the dream and we'll give you the interpretation. Now, the king isn't very eager to tell them the dream. Because in verse 5, we're told, and the king replied to the Chaldeans, the command from me is firm. And if you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, stop. You know what the king wants? The king wants these men to tell him what the dream is and the interpretation. Now, I don't know about you, but if somebody asked me to tell them their dream, I would be stuck. On occasions at neverthirsty.org, we've had people write in and give me a dream and ask me to interpret it. I guess they think I'm a Daniel. Typically, I tell them I can't do that. Well, the Chaldeans, they say, you give me the dream and I'll tell you what it means. And you say, well, how do they do that? Well, a gentleman by the name of Weissman, in his book called Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, on pages 92 to 93, actually gives us some examples of how the Babylonians interpreted dreams. And what he goes on to state is archaeologically they found manuals that the Babylonians used which provided guidelines for interpreting dreams. I thought that was kind of interesting. Kind of like deciphering a code. So if the king had given them this dream, then they would identify certain symbols in the dream. They would then go to their manual and they look up, well, this symbol means this. Oh, and this symbol means that. And they would go through and define what all the different symbols are and what they mean. And then they'd interpret the dream and tell that to the king. So it was kind of like rote. So like having a manual that lists all the symbols and all the meanings. And then all you got to do is take the dream and match it to symbols and you get the meaning of the dream. And so that's really what they're asking for. They're saying, well, king, you give us the dream and we'll go look it up and we'll come back and we'll tell you what this thing means. So the king replies and says, the command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. Now, this king is not a very nice king. He says, you got to tell me the dream. And if you don't, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tear you limb from limb. One idea that one person had is that the king would take four trees and bend them over, tie one arm to one tree, another arm to another tree, one leg to the other tree, and one leg to the fourth tree, and then they would cut the rope and the trees would pop apart and tear the guy apart. Well, maybe that's what he had in mind, I don't know. And then he says, and we'll take your house and make it a rubbish heap. The actual Hebrew means a manure pile. So the king's being really descriptive here. The basic idea is I'm going to destroy you and everything you own. Verse 6, but if you declare the dream and its interpretation, notice the dream and the interpretation are going together. So verse 5 is the threat. Verse 6 is the reward. He says, and if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. Now, can you imagine being a Chaldean standing in front of the king? King sitting on a throne. You're standing there in front of the king. And the king has told you to declare to me the dream and its interpretation. And if you don't, you're toast in your house as well. Now, just imagine. What are you going to do? This king is demanding. He's impatient. And you're standing there. And how are you going to respond? Verse 7, and so they answered a second time. They didn't give up. They recognize now they're in trouble. And so now they're asking, they say, let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation. The king replied, I know for certain that you're bargaining for time. You want to live a little longer. Inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm, and that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you, for you have all agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed, and therefore tell me the dream that I may know that you can tell me the interpretation. You know what the king knew? The king knew that if they could give him the dream, they could then interpret the dream. The king's not stupid. I couldn't help but wonder if while he was a child, you know, dad's king, Nabopolassar's king, couldn't help but wonder maybe as a child he saw these guys come in and give dad a phony interpretation of some dream. I mean, I'm sure he probably heard things like that before as a child. Couldn't help but wonder if maybe he thought, well, these guys, they don't know what they're doing. Or maybe he even saw them go and look, you know, pick up the manual and look through all the symbols to see what the meanings were. And he just said, this is a joke. And so he says, you tell me the dream and then I can trust you for the interpretation. That's what he's saying. Verse 10, and the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there's not a man on earth who can declare the matter for the king. Inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Just imagine standing before this king, recognizing that the king is going to make you toast and your house toast, and he isn't flinching. He's demanding that you tell him the dream. He's keeping it a secret. And these guys say, well, how can you do this? This is impossible. Nobody's ever asked this of us before. This is nuts. Verse 11, moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, say the least. And there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods. Now, as I already pointed out, is that in Babylon, there were lots of gods. There were just lots of them. And so he says, except the God whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. Well, that's their response. So what does the king do? Is the king reasonable? Oh, I understand. And did you notice what they said? They said, no great king, verse 10, inasmuch as no great king or ruler, they're being politically savvy. And so they say, well, no great king has ever done this. They're trying to appeal to him. And verse 12, but because of this, the king became indignant. And not just furious, very furious. and gave orders to destroy all of the wise men of Babylon. Now notice the word all. That's an important little word. It very well may be that all the wise men weren't there. In fact, I believe that all the wise men weren't there. There are some who read this and say, well, Daniel wasn't there in verses 3 and 4. Daniel wasn't at this meeting because Daniel wasn't a wise man yet. He wasn't part of the group yet. Well, I disagree with that because look at verse 13. And so the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. Guess what? Daniel and his friends were classified as wise men. They were part of the wise men. And I suspect that what verse 12 is probably telling us is that not all the wise men were present at the meeting. Now, why was Daniel not present? Why were Daniel and his friends not there? Well, it may be that Daniel was sick. Who knows? It may be that Daniel was preoccupied with some important task that he had as being part of the king's personal service. But what's clear from verse 13 is that he's part of the wise men. And so they come looking for him to kill him. Verse 14. And Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, by the way, executioner, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. And he said to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? That shows you right there that Daniel was not part of the meeting. And then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. And so Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation of the dream. I want you to notice something important here by Daniel. Did you notice what Daniel doesn't do? Daniel doesn't go into a rage and say, oh, this is unjust, this is unfair, how can you do this to me? And he doesn't go around stomping and complaining, running around. Daniel doesn't have, as somebody would say, a spaz attack. I mean, Daniel is calm, he's cool. He's not preoccupied with the injustice. He determines what needs to be done. And he goes in and he asks the king for time. Now, what we're going to discover in the next couple of verses is that he asks for something that he has no guarantee that God's going to do. He has a plan. He goes in and he says, hey, king, he says, give me time. I'm going to go and interpret the dream for you. And so we're told that the king gives him time, verse 17, and then Daniel went into his house. So he goes to his house now. He wasn't at home. Apparently he was in some government facility and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah about the matter. So they didn't know either. So that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, do you notice what he does? He goes in and he asks for compassion. You know what Daniel did? Daniel had not already gone to God and asked for the dream. Daniel didn't know the dream. He didn't know the interpretation yet. He had no guarantee yet that God was going to give him the dream or the interpretation. See what Daniel did when he went into the king and asked for time? He was trusting God. He had faith. Watch this. Remember a little verse in the end of James that says the effective prayer of a righteous man avails much, accomplishes much? We already saw in our previous studies that Daniel's a righteous man. He's a righteous man. He asked for help. God grants it to him. Verse 19, and then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. I just love that. God answers his prayer. God gives him the dream and the interpretation. And notice how Daniel responds. And then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And Daniel said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. This morning, we've been focusing on the character of God. We had a great song sung, How Great Thou Art. And that's exactly what our God is a great God. How great thou art. I looked at the term, says, the name of God. I was interested in that phrase, the name of God. I looked it up to see how many times it occurred in the Old Testament and New Testament. I found out that it occurs only 5 times. It turns out that the name of the Lord shows up 104 times in the Old Testament. And I was thinking about the Israelites at that time, or the Jews, folks who lived in Jerusalem and Judah. If you were to look at 2 Kings 23:24, you would find that we're told that idols filled the land of the Jews. If you were to go to Jeremiah 51:47, you'd find out that we're told that Babylon was filled with idols. Isaiah 19, verse 1 says that idols were all over the land of Egypt. Hosea 2:17 talks about the names of the Baals. Zechariah 13:2 talks about the day is coming when God will cut off the names of the idols. You know what the Scripture is telling us? You know what the Old Testament is telling us? Is that wherever the Jews went, there were the names of other gods. And they were all over the place. Now here in America, in the last 10, 20 years, we've got names of other gods all over the place. It used to be that about the only name you ever heard at all was God, Jehovah God, the God of the Old Testament, New Testament. But today we hear the names of other gods. You know what is really beautiful for me? It's when I come and I talk with other Christians and I hear the name of God. Can you imagine what it would have been like to be a Jew in Babylon with idols everywhere and hearing about Marduk and hearing about all the different kinds of gods that there were? Can you just imagine how beautiful it must have sounded to hear the name of God? Can you imagine? Imagine the beauty of it. And think about this for a second. The Jews revered the name of God so much that even today, if you were to read something from an Orthodox Jew and they wrote the word God, they leave out the vowel. They leave out the O. All you get is GD. They revere the name of God. So when Daniel says, let the name of God, you know what the name of God stands for? Who God is. It's a phrase that refers to who He is. God is revered. God is honored. And if you go to like Psalm 717, the writer of the psalm says, and I will give thanks to the Lord. Sing praises to the name of the Lord Most High. Just honoring the name of God. Who wants to hear about Marduk? Who wants to hear about a heathen God? Who wants to hear about a demon? And then Daniel goes on, it is He who changes the times and the epochs, or you could say seasons. He removes kings and establishes kings. That's what He did with Nebuchadnezzar. Brought him up. We'll see you later, He takes him down. He gives wisdom to wise men, that happened to Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, and knowledge to men of understanding, the same 4 men. It is He who reveals the profound, actual word is secret. It is He who reveals the secret and hidden things. Try dreams, interpretation of dreams. He knows what's in the darkness. I thought that was an incredible statement. Do you know what's in the darkness? Answer is what? Nope, can't see it. Can't see what's in the darkness when it's really dark. If you're getting outer space where it's really dark, dark, you won't see it. And the light dwells with Him. To you, verse 23, Daniel's been describing God. Did you notice all of the attributes of God? Did you notice how incredible God is being described in verse 20, 21, and 22? When you get to verse 23, now he thanks Him. Took him 3 verses to get to thanks. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. And even now you have made known to me what we requested of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. Couldn't help but be reminded of the song, How Great Thou Art. O Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all the worlds your hands have made. I see the stars, I hear the rolling thunder, your power throughout the universe displayed. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee, How great thou art, how great thou art. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art. What a great way to end this study this morning. Praise of the Lord and thanks to God. Well, in our next study, what we're going to see is we're going to see the dream and the interpretation. We're going to get an outline of history all the way to the end of our time. Let's pray.